Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Katie Weaver, Dan Friedel, Marcia James, and Dorothy Gundy. Later, John Russell and Jill Robbins will bring us this week's lesson in everyday grammar. But first, opponents of the Venezuelan government have promised to continue street protests aimed at forcing out President Nicolas Maduro. The opposition warning came a day after at least two people were killed and hundreds arrested in Venezuela's largest anti-government demonstrations in years. Thousands of Venezuelans filled the main streets of the capital, Caracas, on Wednesday. Many demonstrated in support of the president. Many others protested against Maduro and socialist policies. Security forces armed with tear gas were deployed in a neighborhood on the west side of Caracas. One teenager shot in the head near an anti-government protest died while doctors operated on him. Pro-government militias were blamed for his death, as well as the killing of a woman in the city of San Cristobal. Venezuelan officials are investigating the events leading up to both deaths. A National Guard soldier was reported killed during protest in Miranda State, near Caracas. At least eight people have been killed since the political unrest started 3 weeks ago. Wednesday's protest fell on an important date for Venezuelans. On April 19, 1810, Venezuelans began their drive for independence from Spain. In Washington, United States officials are worried the Venezuelan government is working to suppress the opposition. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said, "We are concerned that the government of Maduro is violating its own constitution and not allowing the opposition to have their voices heard, nor allowing them to organize in a way that expressed the views of the Venezuelan people. We are concerned about that situation," he added. "We're watching it closely and working with others to communicate those concerns to them." Tillerson spoke at the State Department on Wednesday. In recent protests, security forces have fired rubber bullets, tear gas, and water cannons. The demonstrations began after a Venezuelan Supreme Court ruling on March 30th. The court said it would take away the legislative powers of the opposition-controlled National Assembly. However, the court overturned its position after national and international criticism about an attempt to seize power. Maduro's opponents gathered in Caracas on Wednesday to pressure his administration to respect the assembly's autonomy. They also want the government to hold long-delayed elections, free political prisoners, and restore other democratic customs. The National Socialist Party has ruled Venezuela for 17 years. Economic pressures have grown in recent years. The price of oil, Venezuela's chief export, began falling in 2014. Venezuelans also face severe shortages of food, medicine, and basic goods. In related news, the American car manufacturer General Motors has stopped doing business in Venezuela after the government took control of its only factory in the country. In a statement Thursday, the company said vehicles and other property were also seized, causing irreparable damage to the company.
The Chinese government is looking to foreign businesses to help find oil and natural gas under the South China Sea. Yet China expects to meet resistance because other countries dispute Chinese territorial claims to much of the sea. In addition, observers say any oil and gas discoveries might not be very profitable. Last week, China's state-operated China National Offshore Oil Corporation made an appeal for foreign help. The company said it wants to work with foreign businesses in exploring for fossil fuels in 22 areas south of the country's coast. When combined, that represents more than 47,000 square kilometers of territory. The governments in Taiwan and Vietnam also claim those waters. Vietnam has been outspoken about its claims since the 1970s. Foreign oil companies are now studying the Chinese offer, which closes in September. Experts say the companies may be worried that any work they do for China could hurt their ability to work for other countries. And they say the companies may also be worried that any oil or gas they find could be claimed by China's neighbors. Thomas Pugh works for the Capital Economics Research Service in London. He says if foreign companies start working with China and Chinese firms, they could risk not being allowed to work with other countries who are disputing ownership of the area. Raymond Wu is the managing director of eTelligence, a Taipei-based service that specializes in political risk. He also notes that any oil and gas discoveries could be claimed by other countries. The other contestant parties do not accept that China has sovereign claims, Wu said. He noted that foreign companies must face, in his words, not only the difficulty or uncertainty of finding oil, but who does the oil belong to? I don't see many investors willing to get into it at this point. In May 2014, Vietnamese and Chinese boats sailed into each other near the Gulf of Tonkin after China deployed oil drilling equipment in the area. Brunei, Malaysia, and the Philippines have been worried about Chinese attempts to increase control over about 95% of the 3.5 million square kilometer sea. Over the past 10 years, Chinese crews have been creating islands for military aircraft and radar systems. Companies need costly equipment to search for oil and gas, and it is not clear how much of it they will find. Zhao Hedrin is the deputy chief of the School of Finance at Ringming University of China. He says the China National Offshore Oil Corporation is working to lessen the risk of exploration by working with foreign companies. The first thing is that risk is pretty high, and second, the technical requirements are rather high, Zhao said. So perhaps the organizations or companies able to participate in this project would face a certain hurdle. Experts say falling oil prices would limit the value of any undersea discoveries. World oil prices have fallen from more than $100 per barrel in 2013 to about half that. The United States Energy Information Administration estimates there are about 11 billion barrels of oil under the sea, and 190 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. Over 40 years ago, the Philippines began searching for oil west of Palawan Island at Reed Bank. In 1984, a Philippine company discovered an oil field in the area. It now supplies 15% of the oil used in the Philippines. Malaysia has found about 5 billion barrels of oil and 80 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, more than any other country with territorial claims to the South China Sea. I'm Katie Weaver.
Zimbabwe wants small businesses to be able to get credit to start or grow a business. If the country's parliament approves a bill proposed last week, business owners will be able to use cows, cars, machines, and other movable property to secure loans. In most countries, people use their home or land they own to secure a bank loan. But in countries where the economy is struggling, many people do not have those assets. If the bill passes, Zimbabwe will join other African nations, including Liberia, Ghana, Kenya, Lesotho, and Malawi, that use movable assets to secure loans. The law would let the Zimbabwean government consider movable assets as any tangible or intangible property that is not immovable. Finance Minister Patrick Chinamasa introduced the bill so Zimbabwe's informal businesses could get bank loans more easily. The movable assets used to secure loans would be registered in a database set up by the central bank. Chinamasa said banks have not changed their policies to deal with the current economy in Zimbabwe. The country used to have many more traditional business loans that were secured by land and homes. But that changed when President Robert Mugabe seized farms and other property held by white owners between 2000 and 2008. The farms became less productive and the country's economy declined. Instead of having large farms, Zimbabwe became a country of smaller farms and smaller businesses. the economy became less traditional and more informal, but the banks did not adjust. Chinamasa said he wants banks to change their attitudes in order to reflect our economic realities. Chinamasa said he wants loans to small businesses to grow. So far this year, small business loans have accounted for only $250 million out of $4 billion of bank loans. In his proposal to Parliament, Chinamasa said movable assets increased the number of loans given to small businesses in countries where non-traditional assets were accepted as security. He added that interest rates in those countries also fell. I'm Dan Friedel.
For more than 50 years, photographer Horace Pula captured the lives of members of his American Indian tribe. Now, the National Museum of the American Indian is showing the American Indian photographer's rare work. The exhibit is called For a Love of His People, The Photography of Horace Pula. Pula's photos show the cultural assimilation that was taking place in American Indian communities during his lifetime. Pula was a member of the Kiowa tribe. He took pictures of American Indian subjects. He used pictures to form a history of his friends, family, and events important to them.
Horace Pula was born in 1906 in Mountain View, Oklahoma. Until the late 19th century, Oklahoma's Indian territory belonged to tribes native to the area or that had been sent there from other parts of the country. Pula's tribe is called the Kiowa Comanche. They lived with the Apache tribe on a reservation that covered 1.2 million hectares of land. But 20 years later, a law known as the Dawes Act permitted Congress to divide the land. Individual Indians were given their own land. The rest was opened up to non-native settlers. Horace Pula lived with his parents in a traditional teepee early in life. His father, Kiowa George, was the son of a warrior. Pula's mother was descended from a Mexican woman who had been captured during a Kiowa raid. They moved into a house that still remains with the family today. Then settlers from the east came to live in Mountain View. Photographer George W. Long moved there and became a mentor to Pula. He gave the young man his first camera.
Pula's photos captured images of Kiowa women wearing traditional American Indian clothes and Kiowas in cars with headdresses. But he had very little money to make photographs. He developed his own pictures, even though there was no electricity or water in the house back in those days. He had to send to Chicago for film and developing supplies. The high cost of photographic paper and film meant that Pula worked hard to get his pictures right on the first try. He developed only a small number of the photographs he took. and he took all of his photographs outdoors so he would not need lighting equipment.
Pula continued taking pictures until the 1970s, when his eyesight began to fail. In 1979, the Southern Plains Indian Museum in Anadarko organized an exhibit of his photographs. It would be the only showing of his work during his lifetime. In the late 1980s, Pula's daughter Linda established a research program at Stanford University to archive and digitize her father's work. Today, art historians and critics consider Pula's work equal to many better-known photographers working in the Western United States in the early 20th century. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Marcia James.
From VOA Learning English, this is Everyday Grammar. Almost every American has seen or heard of the movie Forrest Gump. The film is a touching story about the life of a man who faces many challenges. One of the most famous quotes from Forrest Gump is this.
My mom always said, life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
These lines might interest you for two reasons. First, if you mention them to an American, they will probably know what you are talking about. Second, if you study the lines carefully, you can learn how complex grammar is used in everyday speech. Today on Everyday Grammar, we are going to explore how Americans use noun clauses in speech. Just like Gump's box of chocolates, this report might have a pleasant surprise for you.
Noun clauses are groups of words that act as a noun. They often begin with words such as if, what, why, and so on. These clauses have a subject and a predicate, just like a sentence. However, they do not act as sentences on their own. Instead, they have an effect on a longer, more complex sentence. Here is an example. Imagine you do not know the answer to a question in your mathematics class. You could ask, "I wonder if my teacher knows the answer." In the sentence, the main clause, "I wonder," is followed by the if noun clause, "if my teacher knows the answer." In this report, we are talking about noun clauses that begin with the words what, why, where, and so on. Let's call them WH clauses. In technical language, you could call them subordinators. They can act as subjects, objects, complements, and so on. The good news is this. Americans commonly use if and WH noun clauses in a few expressions. Generally, such expressions have one of the following verbs: know, see, and wonder. We will use lines from popular movies and short examples to show you how Americans use these verbs with different noun clauses.
Consider this line from the 2004 film Million Dollar Baby.
No matter where he is, I thought you should know what kind of man your father really was.
In the sentence, the word what leads to a clause that comes after the verb know. This is a common pattern in American English. If you were to visit the United States, you would probably hear expressions such as, I know what, or I don't know what, almost every day. Speakers will also use different WH words to introduce clauses. For example, you could say, I thought you should know why I came here. Or you could say, I thought you should know where to find the post office. You will also hear if noun clauses with the verb know. For example, imagine that a person asked you, do you know if the museum is near here? You could say, no, I don't know if the museum is near here.
Another word that is commonly followed by an if or WH noun clause is the verb see. Consider this line from the 1998 film, The Truman Show.
You want another slice?
No, I'm okay.
What else is on?
Yeah, let's see what else.
Where's the TV guy?
Americans will often use the words, let's see what, or let's see if, to make a suggestion, as in the line from The Truman Show. At other times, speakers will use let's see in an informal way. They do not necessarily mean it as a suggestion. Consider this quote from the 1999 film, The Green Mile.
Mr. Jenkins? Where you been?
Been worried about you, boy. You hungry? Let's go see if we can't find you something to eat.
These lines show you how some Americans speak, notably in the southeastern United States. The speaker is clearly not making a suggestion. Instead, he is speaking to himself in an indirect way. Although he uses the negative can't, he actually means can.
Another word that is commonly used with an if or WH noun clause is the verb wonder. The structure I wonder if is commonly used to ask a question. Remember the example, I wonder if my teacher knows the answer? Speakers will also use WH clauses with the verb wonder. Many forgetful people have probably said, I wonder where my keys are, for example.
Now that you have learned about if and WH clauses, think back to the film Forrest Gump.
My mom always said, life was like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get.
Did you notice that Gump uses one of the common grammatical structures that we have talked about in this report? Although you might not suspect it, every time you watch an American film, listen to American music, or talk to an American, you can learn more grammar. All of the structures we have studied today are considered polite and can be used in formal or informal speech. They also can be used in writing. The next time you are watching an American film, try to find complex grammatical structures like the ones we talked about. Listen for the words know, see, and wonder. What types of noun clauses do speakers use? How do they organize their sentences? This process might be difficult, but remember this, you know what you should do. I'm John Russell.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.